From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. This show is heard on radio stations around the world, including Main FM 103.5, Asheville, North Carolina, and CIDO 97.7 FM, Creston, BC. On today's episode, a brief update to last week's investigative report on the BC-based egg business who was marketing their product as coming from chickens on their own farm, when upon an undercover visit to the property, it became apparent that there were no chickens, and that this was in no way a farm. We check in with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency's James Rogowski, who, while not being able to provide too much detail on this particular case that Deconstructing Dinner had initially alerted them to, he does shed some light on how the CFIA goes about investigating these types of complaints. And with that, we then present part three in our series, Exploring Ethnobiology. Some fascinating topics to learn about today, including the work of Severin Cullis Suzuki, who, studying under the advisory role of Nancy Turner and John Volpe, among others, conducted her master's research on the traditional harvesting of eelgrass by the Kwakwaka'wakw of northern Vancouver Island. We also hear presentations by Josh Wisniewski, a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who has spent time researching Inupiaq hunters in the community of Shishmaref, Alaska, and the complex relationships of these people with the marine mammals that they hunt. Also lending their voice once again to this series, Nancy Turner of the University of Victoria, who will help introduce what a keystone species is, which for ethnobiologists and related disciplines is an important marker, helping affirm the importance of the relationships formed between humans, plants, animals, and ecosystems. On September 2nd, Deconstructing Dinner aired a startling investigative report that has since sent a wake-up call to anyone who has been advocating for and supporting local food systems. After receiving a series of tips alleging that a BC-based egg business was falsely marketing their product as coming from their own chickens and their own farm, Deconstructing Dinner went to find out for itself, visiting the property and discovering that, yes, there were no chickens on the property and no indication from the owners as to where the eggs were coming from. The day before that show went to air, we contacted the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, alerting them to what we had discovered. That investigation is now underway, and there isn't much to update you on. But to give you a sense of how the CFIA undertakes this type of work, I spoke with the CFIA's James Rogowski, an eggs product specialist based in Winnipeg.
I guess the first thing is obviously we would gather information about the complaint, what the particular complaint is about a particular egg grading station, whether it be on their claim or whatever, and then we would go to the egg grading station to do an inspection to see if that complaint is valid or not, and take whatever notes we need to take if by interviewing the staff or inspecting product, looking at labels to try and see if there's any validity to the complaint or not.
The business in question, known as Eggs R Us, had been communicating to their 18 customers, retailers and restaurants, that their eggs were from their own farm and from neighboring farms in the Creston Valley. While Deconstructing Dinner has confirmed that there is no farm at the address of the business, as to the latter claim that the eggs are coming from neighboring farms, well, that too is also questionable, as we also received an allegation that the eggs were coming from Alberta. James Rogowski speaks to the specifics of this particular complaint that the CFIA is now investigating.
My understanding, the concern was about the claim of it being of them selling local eggs. We would interview the owners of the egg station, look at their records to see where their eggs are coming from, whether they're producing the eggs on farm themselves, or if they're buying eggs from other egg producers in the area. Terms such as local or locally grown allows them to purchase eggs from a 50-kilometer radius around their farm and grade those and package those and still call those locally grown. So we would, interview them and look at their records to see where they're sourcing those eggs from.
Now, while Deconstructing Dinner has not come across any instances when Eggs R Us was specifically marketing the product as, quote, local, they do communicate that their product is coming from the local area, and they label their products as a, quote, product of Windle, BC. As James Rogowski indicates, marketing a product as local receives careful scrutiny, as to how local the product really is.
It's in the food labeling guide where we've had to come up with some definition around, you know, what is the definition or what is considered, you know, reasonable for locally or locally grown. And it talks about, you know, goods being advertised or, you know, as originating within 50 kilometers of the place where they were produced. And basically how that is done is, taking the point of the point of sale and drawing a circle 50 kilometers out to, you know, in any farms or eggs produced within a 50-kilometer zone would be considered locally grown for that claim.
Now, in this particular case, some of the most important information that Deconstructing Dinner and the public are now awaiting is just where were those eggs coming from. One of the regulations that supports us accessing that information is the Shell Egg Grading Regulation, in which it's outlined how a registered egg grading station like Eggs R Us is required to keep track of the eggs passing through their operation.
The only requirements is that they are required to report to us the volume of eggs that they are grading over a period of time. They do not have to tell us where those eggs are originating from. That is the type of a record that they would keep for themselves. In the event that we needed to go back and do a trace back, for instance, similar to any type of food products, we need to know where the eggs in that carton originated from. So we would go back to them, say, you must be able to tell us where these eggs were sourced from. So those are records they would keep.
As a last point of information that I spoke about with the CFIA's James Rogowski, we discussed the requirement for egg grading stations to report to the CFIA the volume of eggs being graded. Now, certainly with that information in hand, it should be an easy enough task to compare those reported volumes to those that their 18 customers have been purchasing.
Those records should match fairly closely. There's going to be obviously some loss. You're dealing with a perishable product or a product that, an egg can certainly crack, or if you drop a box of eggs, you're going to have some loss. But there should be some close figures there on the amount of eggs that were purchased and then actually were graded or sold out the door.
James Rogowski, an eggs product specialist with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. James spoke to Deconstructing Dinner from Winnipeg. James added that Eggs R Us has, since our report aired, surrendered their registration to Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. You can expect a more detailed follow-up on this story, including what lessons we might all be able to glean from this case on an upcoming episode. You can also stay posted to our website and our Facebook page for more on this case, including a link to last week's one-hour investigative report, our short video produced using footage from our visit to the business, and a link to a piece that I authored about this investigation for the online news source News in the Coots. And all of that is accessible and linked to from deconstructingdinner.ca.
Well, ethnobiology is really the study of people and the natural world, especially the study of people and their relationships with plants and animals, and especially people who have direct relationships with their surroundings, the plants and animals that grow in their own home places.
That's Nancy Turner of the University of Victoria, who was our feature guest on part two of this Exploring Ethnobiology series. That was back in July when that episode first aired. And we'll hear from Nancy again on today's show because her efforts to introduce the ethnobiological use of the concept Keystone Species really helps introduce another voice that we'll hear in just a moment later on the show of Severin Cullis Suzuki, the daughter of David Suzuki, who has spent her master's research studying an important keystone species, eelgrass, or to the Kwakwaka'wakw of northern Vancouver Island, Tsetse'em. But first, Nancy Turner, on what a keystone species is to an ethnobiologist.
Well, the idea of a keystone species has originally comes from ecology, and there's a very specific meaning for an ecological keystone species. It's a species that has a very strong influence on the entire community of plants and animals where it lives. In some way, maybe if you think of pollinating bees or something, if you remove those, even though in terms of their overall weight or biomass or whatever, they're not the main component in the ecosystem. But if you were to remove them from the ecosystem, the whole thing would change. The composition would change because there's nothing pollinating those flowers. And so they don't produce seeds, and then they're going to be outcompeted by maybe wind-pollinated species, and the whole composition is going to change and maybe flip to something totally different. Mm-hmm. And we started thinking about these amazing parallel processes that happen in human societies as that kind of parallel what happens in ecological systems. And there's been a lot of work in that, linking social ecological systems and how they're inextricably linked. But then we started thinking about, you know, how can we communicate that those linkages? And one way is to borrow terms from the ecological world and apply them in the parallel way to the social world or the cultural world, and vice versa. So we have the term health, for example, which is a cultural social term, human health, but now is widely applied in as ecological health or ecosystem health, which everyone can then understand better when you say that, what it means to have an ecosystem that's not healthy, it's not functioning properly, the natural processes aren't occurring, and often it's because of our human impact on it. Mm-hmm. And so we were thinking of other processes and other ideas that we could borrow from to help communicate as common ideas. And we thought about this notion that in every society, in every place in the world, there are certain species that are particularly relevant to those people. And that can change over time, but almost everywhere there are these species that people identify with. They think of them as part of their identity. So you have, for example, the Menominee, the people of the wild rice, Menomon, the Anishinaabe people. They are, name themselves after one of their main foods. And you often hear on this coast, the northwest coast, the people of the salmon and the people of the cedar. And so these are iconic species that people associate with, that if they weren't there, the people's identity would be different, would change their identity. Mm-hmm. And they're species that were so important in the past, but because of these changes have been eliminated and people don't associate with them anymore. And so we started thinking, if we consider those to be keystone, cultural keystone species, it's a way of communicating their importance and their value in a way that many people would understand, in a way that scientists might understand better from looking at a social system, how important, how much, you know, heartfelt importance these species have to people's well-being and identity. And then, so if we're talking about renewal and restoring cultures, languages, and even ecosystems, we can sort of focus on those species as ones that could be then used as the crest or the, not a motto exactly, but something that represents and symbolizes the entire culture. Right. And could be an effective way then of having people understand and become more committed to the entire system of knowledge or species or whatever. And so we've thought about that. Other parallels, for example, my students and I gave a paper in back east on symbiosis, and we talk about symbiosis as an ecological and a biological process of two or more organisms that come together and live together or help each other in some way for mutual benefit. And there's a whole range of different roles that these species can play. So the honeybee, the pollinator, flowering plant symbiosis, There's the lichen symbiosis, where you have an alga and a fungus growing so closely together that they work as one organism, but each one contributes in a different way. The algae, the photosynthetic capacity, and then the fungi becomes the main kind of substrate, the way of absorbing the water and nutrients for this wonderful combined plant. And we used the notion of the
CSA
as an example of a social symbiosis. It's a wonderful partnership that people have developed, that where people support each other to the mutual benefit of both. And there's many, many other examples of this kind of symbiosis that can take place at a cultural level. And your contribution in a symbiotic relationship could be just at one particular point in time, like providing the pollen at the right time for pollination to occur, and then you don't connect at another time. Or it can be more of a sustained contribution. It just depends on the situation. But that's another example of a term and a parallel concept that you can use in communicating ideas.
Nancy Turner, an ethnoecologist with the University of Victoria. More from Nancy Turner is archived on our website under the July 22nd, 2010 episode, but that unheard segment from that interview on what a keystone species is does help introduce this next voice here on Deconstructing Dinner, Severin Cullis Suzuki, who received her master's in ethnobotany from the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria, where she studied under Nancy Turner, among others. Similar to her father, David Suzuki, Severin has devoted herself to helping increase awareness on some fundamental ecological concerns. Born and raised in Vancouver, at the age of 9, Severin founded the Environmental Children's Organization. In 1992, at the age of 12, she attended the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, where she received a lot of praise for her speech that she delivered there. She went on to graduate from Yale University in 2002, hosted a television series on Discovery Channel, and eventually was led to study ethnobotany under Nancy Turner. Her focus of research led her to northern Vancouver Island, home of the Kwakwaka'wakw people. It was there that Severin studied the keystone species Zostera marina, also known as eelgrass, or to the Kwakwaka'wakw, Tsatsayam. Found only in the northern hemisphere, eelgrass is known to increase biodiversity and ocean productivity and is a sensitive indicator of ecosystem stability. The Kwakwaka'wakw traditionally had gathered eelgrass for food and other uses, but it's been 30 years now since that was last practiced. It's known that certain harvesting practices of eelgrass rhizomes can increase their productivity, and so the study of these traditional harvesting practices can also help strengthen the notion that we as humans can insert ourselves within a finely tuned ecosystem and enrich it, instead of throwing ecosystems out of balance, which we appear to know all too well how to do. Severin studied eelgrass through the scientific lens of ecology and also through the lens of the traditional harvesting practices, which she learned from the Kwakwaka'wakw elders. Deconstructing Dinner recorded Severin speaking in May 2010 at the annual gathering of the Society of Ethnobiologists, held this year at the University of Victoria.
So my objectives today are really to use both of these perspectives, use both the traditional ecological knowledge and ecology to look at how eelgrass beds were traditionally harvested, and I use the term tended as opposed to cultivated, but tended in an effort to harvest in a sustainable way, non-destructive sustainable way, and also to use traditional knowledge as a hypothesis to be tested using the more scientific perspective, using the information I gleaned from expeditions, from my experiments in situ, and of course from the literature. And I found they complemented really well. So quickly, Victoria gave a great introduction to Zostera marina. Of course, when I started this study, I had no idea that eelgrass actually makes the world go round, as I now know. Without question. It is famous because of its ecological significance in the Northern Hemisphere. A very important species. It is essential to our coastlines as habitat for a plethora of creatures and different organisms in different stages of their life cycle. It's even protected by our federal government because of this, because it's so essential to our coastal ecosystems as the nurseries of our ocean. It grows extremely fast, and its high proliferation of biomass really feeds the food web as well through its detritus. And it is this vast amount of biomass that it produces that has also facilitated a lot of the human uses of eelgrass, as Victoria mentioned, the roof thatch, the bedding, the animal fodder, the felt that was formed from this detritus to form insulation. That is all because eelgrass just grows so fast that we have this huge volume that we have used throughout history. I could go on and on about all the uses of eelgrass. But one of the things that I just only recently have really keyed into eelgrass as a value for humans, as an ethnobotanical use, well, if you could call it that, is its importance as a carbon sink. And I only recently learned about this report from a collaboration of the UNEP, of the United Nations Environment Program, and all these other organizations, about blue carbon. And blue carbon just signifies carbon sinks that are found in the world's oceans. And in fact, most of the carbon sinks in the world are actually in the sea. And within the sea environment, seagrasses and salt marshes are a very important part of the carbon uptake from the atmosphere, and we call those carbon sinks. I'll just read this quote. The ocean's vegetated habitats, in particular mangroves, salt marshes, and seagrasses, cover 0.5% of the seabed. These form Earth's blue carbon sinks and account for more than 50% to perhaps as much as 71% of the carbon storage in ocean sediments. So they comprise only a small percentage of plant biomass on the Earth, but they store a huge amount of carbon per year. And so they're very, very important to the Earth's atmosphere and the maintenance of our and the stability of our climate. So this may turn out to be one of the most important human uses for our seagrasses that is emerging in the 21st century. My study looked at the Zostera marina of our southern BC coast and how it was used by Kwakwaka'wakw First Nations, and their main use, or their use for the species was as food, and they would eat the rhizomes of these plants. Quickly, a brief introduction to the also famous Kwakwaka'wakw First Nations. This group was probably very well known in the anthropological world, specifically thanks to the work that Franz Boas did in the early 20th century. Their territory is northern Vancouver Island and the adjacent mainland. The different colors signify the different language groups within the Kwakwaka'wakw. They speak 9 different dialects, and they have various forms of political organizations within these areas. They're a coastal people, obviously, and they also are people of mountains and rivers and estuaries, as you can see from their very diverse territory, and they would practice the seasonal round, moving throughout different locations through their territory within the year, following the different available foods. And eelgrass was a desirable food in the month of May. One quick point of this research. It's been approximately 30 years since Tsaatsiam was harvested for its sweet rhizomes in May. Since contact in 1792, when George Vancouver circumnavigated Vancouver Island and encountered the Likwakdaw on Cape Mudge, Kwakwaka'wakw group, there of course have been huge changes to the culture of the Kwakwaka'wakw. Huge shifts, huge nutritional shifts as well, as many of you are familiar with. And the current social context for this study is that, of course, their traditional knowledge is going through a massive or a very small bottleneck. And And this is a classic example of the cultures on our coast at this time. And so this is the serious context for doing research on our coast today.
Severin Cullis Suzuki. Severin went on to describe some of the harvesting techniques that were employed in her research, and she describes how, when asking the Kwakwaka'wakw elders why they harvest in May, they responded, because this is how it's done. Severin also spoke of the nutritional value of eelgrass rhizomes.
I did different harvesting experiments. After learning from the elders how they would harvest this plant in the spring, I tried to mimic the removal and removed plants at various intensities as a treatment, and then studied the effects on the remaining plants and the new shoot production over the summer, trying to get a sense from the plant's perspective of how this kind of patchy disturbance would have affected the plant community. From my interviews and ethnobotanical records in the expeditions, many Kwakwaka'wakw harvesting protocols became crystal clear. I mean, there definitely were distinct ways of harvesting this plant. And I would ask often, well, why do we harvest eelgrass in May? And the response back was, because May is the eelgrass harvesting month, because this is the way it is done. And so I was curious about the rationale that would have gone into these protocols, and that's what I found the scientific method really, really useful for. And through the research, me going out and trying to, in my experiment and also through other people's experiments, I found the two really complemented quite well in painting a clear picture of the understanding that went into developing these protocols. So first of all, eelgrass was a great source of carbohydrates. People love to eat eelgrass. Across the board, people raved about the taste and called it their candy. There definitely is enough sugar in eelgrass rhizomes to warrant the adoration that we had from several elders about this candy. The rhizomes of eelgrass are the main storage organs for carbohydrates. And it's been found that eelgrass specifically has more than 50% of the dry weight of the rhizomes as sucrose. So it actually obviously is very, very sweet. It's common for plants' rhizomes to be carbohydrate reserves, but this high proportion of sucrose, of sugar, rather than starch in Zoster marina rhizomes, make this a very desirable plant. It's also been found that the sucrose levels are actually at their highest in the early summer. In early June, it's been found. So it makes sense that, of course, this would be the desirable time to be harvesting these delicious rhizomes. I was taught that of those delicious rhizomes, you only eat the first four internodes. So the rhizomes grow in these increments, and only the first four are to be eaten because four is the sacred number of the Kwakwaka'wakw. Well, it's also, in the scientific literature, the fourth internode is the first mature internode of the eelgrass growth, and those new internodes have not yet lignified. They have not yet become woody, and therefore have low cellulose, easier to digest, and it makes far more sense. Also, those first four internodes have the highest nutritional value as well. So it makes absolute sense. You'd only eat the first four. The way of eating these rhizomes along with one of the leaves is very complex. Well, not complex, but very difficult, very energy intensive. You peel it down, and then you wrap the innermost leaf around the rhizome. There's a reason for that as well. It's been found that the innermost leaf of the rhizome shoots, of the eelgrass shoots, is the highest in nitrogen and the lowest in cellulose. So it actually indicates that it would have nutritional value and also be digestible enough to warrant this extensive process of peeling. Another teaching: dried plants are not good to eat. So Daisy Seaweed Smith taught me that there was a taboo against eating dried up eelgrass. Well, why? When we went into the field, it was obvious that if you harvested dried up eelgrass, tried to pick it by hand, it would be very hard to remove. So in a few inches of water, much easier. But also, I learned from several ecologists at a conference that there is sulfide intrusion that can happen if plants are exposed for too long. And that's when you get that rotten egg smell, because the plant's rhizomes have been exposed, the oxic layer is being intruded upon by sulfides, and you get some breakdown, which indicates that you'd have less nutritional value. Harvesting in May is optimal for human consumption. It's the time when you have the highest amount of sugars and the highest amount of nutritional value, lowest amount of cellulose. It's also optimal for eelgrass meadows. It's at a time when growth is just, it's the eelgrass has been waiting all winter for the light, and finally its growth is just taking off. And if you remove plants at this time, it has the entire summer to catch up and to send new shoots into the surrounding space that has been left. It's actually the best time, and there's several different papers that point to different removal and ice scraping of eelgrass patches that actually have promoted growth by the end of the summer.
And in this last segment from Severin Cullis Suzuki's presentation at the annual gathering of the Society of Ethnobiologists, she shared some of the important lessons learned from doing this work, one being that the traditional knowledge of the Kwakwaka'wakw is not necessarily accompanied with a rationale, such as the way with which Western knowledge is so strongly built upon.
Of course, I've just rushed through it. I haven't even talked to you about how amazing it is that they use a kill bayou to push down into the intermediate depths and twist and then pull up the eelgrass like spaghetti. That's one of the ways of harvesting. But they always harvested from just subtidal levels, and this actually makes the best sense also from a stability point of view and from the health of the rhizome. Harvesting eelgrass could increase shoot production, and harvesting eelgrass could result in larger remaining rhizomes. These two statements, I couldn't find elders who said they were actually taught to harvest in a way that promoted growth. But these were within the ethics that they conducted all their plant harvesting. They were so confident that of course they would have harvested in a way that not only would have maintained these dens, but would have actually enhanced these plants. And this is definitely corroborated by a lot of the research coming out, specifically Nancy Turner and Doug Doerr's research that has shown that people were actively tending and aiding the plants that they were harvesting. It makes absolute sense. But every protocol that I gleaned from the knowledge of these elders was backed up several times by the ecological research and by my experiments that I conducted. It was really just amazing to see that though the rationale is not taught with the traditional knowledge, there is ample evidence. And it really was wonderful for me to realize that these two perspectives can really be a guideline for our way moving forward in dealing with this really important ecologically significant resource. So thank you very much.
Severin Cullis Suzuki speaking in May 2010 at the University of Victoria. Severin lives on the islands of Haida Gwaii. Links to more information about her work are posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and the September 9th, 2010 broadcast. This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. That musical break was courtesy of Blue Tech and his song Prayers for Rain off the album Elementary Particles. Today marks part three in our series exploring ethnobiology. Ethnobiology is the scientific study of relationships between people, plants, animals, and ecosystems from the distant past to the immediate present. Earlier this year, Deconstructing Dinner chose to devote a lot of attention to this relatively unknown field of study, as it's become clear just how important it is today more than ever, perhaps, for all peoples to learn about the ways in which peoples around the world have and are living symbiotically with the Earth. In May 2010, two ethnobiology conferences were held on Vancouver Island, with today's recordings coming from my visit to the gathering of the Society of Ethnobiology held this year in Victoria. Another researcher there who was also sharing his work on the relationships between Indigenous peoples and the marine environment was Josh Wisniewski, a PhD student in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Josh has worked with Kikitamu Inupiaq hunters and elders exploring and documenting their hunting practices of bearded seals. What he discovered is that instead of the type of knowledge that Western cultures so often rely upon, some Kikitamu hunters rely in part on what a Westerner might describe as luck and a practice of self-regulation. Josh introduced his research by sharing the history of settlements along Alaska's western coastline, the Bering Sea, and the development of cooperative harvesting strategies of marine mammals.
By 10,000 BP, before present, post-Pleistocene warming had contributed to a successive rise in sea levels to approximately 50 meters below current levels, and by 5,000 BP to within 2 meters of current levels in the Chukchi and Bering Sea waters. And human populations we know have occupied the eastern Bering Sea shore for a minimum of 9,000 years, with marine mammal hunting forming an important aspect of the regional coastal subsistence practices. Following the stabilization of sea level about 4,500 to 4,200 years BP, we see coastal sites further north in the Bering Sea, and it's here where we see the first evidence of winter ice hunting. And that's in the Norton Sound region of the Bering Sea. By 2500 BP, we see the emergence of what were then classified as Eskimo technologies based on excavations on St. Lawrence Island. And concurrent with these technological innovations, evidence suggests that here we see the development of cooperative strategies for harvesting bowhead whales and walrus, which facilitated the growth of large sedentary villages of up to 1,000 people, being the largest in the Arctic prior to Euro-American colonization. At the same time, cultural materials from this era forward, from hunting equipment to items of daily household usage, begin to be decorated with animals that display human facial expressions. And when you view these in light of oral traditions documented by ethnographers in the late 19th and early 20th century, as well as ongoing research, these objects suggest that local understandings of sentience, of being, and of personhood as not limited to humans was developed in the Bering Strait and in northwest Alaska by at least 2,000 years ago. And certainly today, marine mammal hunting remains vitally important for Bering Strait communities, as I hope to illuminate with the next part of this discussion. The Bering Strait community of Shishmaref today is in a predominantly Inupiaq community, located on a small barrier island on the northwestern shore of the Seward Peninsula. Historically, it was only one of a series of seasonally occupied communities along that coast that began to consolidate in Shishmaref following the establishment of a school and a reindeer herding station there in 1906. By 1920, approximately 131 people called Shishmaref their seasonal winter home, and today over 600 people call it home. The most economically and socially significant animal pursued by hunters in Shishmaref is the bearded seal, Araganthus barbatus, or as they're known in Bering Strait dialect of Inupiaq as Ugzhruk, or Ugzhruit in the plural form. Bearded seals can weigh up to 700 pounds and are the largest of the ice seals that normally occur in Alaskan Arctic and subarctic waters. In 1977 to 1978, the estimated value of a bearded seal for an Inupiaq family was approximately $286. If we move forward through time and adopt a conservative estimate of about 500 pounds for a dressed mature bearded seal and draw upon the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Subsistence Division, they have a replacement value of approximately $5 per pound of wild meat. We can estimate that the average Ugzhruk to be worth approximately $2,500 for a household economy. And on average, most Shishmaref hunting households try to catch a minimum of 4 adult Ugzhruks to last a year. And so that contributes about $10,000 towards household economies.
The focus of Josh Wisniewski's work has been on the relationships that have formed between the Inupiaq hunters that he spent time with and the bearded seals which they hunt. Josh explained the method that the hunters use of self-regulating themselves through what a Westerner might refer to as luck.
Today, though, a central tenet of hunting in Shishmaref are the comments of elders that animals won't always be present or accessible, and that periods of relative abundance of animals will be followed by times of hardship. Don't play with animals, don't ever assume you can fully know animals or the environment, and don't act in any way that suggests these things. These ideas are part of a continuously emerging set of shared understandings wherein older beliefs, local history, and personal experiential explanations are continuously synthesized and drawn upon in order to understand and explain the world. Some younger hunters call this Eskimo law or Kikitamu law, while others just call it the rules of old folks. An example of how this is understood is in recent years there's been a dramatic expansion of the muskox, which were reintroduced by the state of Alaska, and there's been a dramatic expansion of the Western Arctic caribou herd onto the Seward Peninsula, which has devastated local commercial reindeer herds. Hunters also discuss how Ugzhruk hunting is today much more difficult compared to what they experienced 20 years ago. Then hunters had more days to hunt, different hunting conditions related to a different quality of sea ice. At the same time, this idea, this notion of variability and unpredictability form a norm in hunting life. So hunters' experiences with fluctuations and changes, however, are considered in conjunction with these older ideas, what people would call the rules of old folks. These inform how hunters try to achieve short and long-term success, or as people will call it, luck, through varied self-regulatory actions. Here, we see the avoidance of certain topics of discussion, and significantly, the recognition of the power of Ugzhruks and the self-regulation during hunts both play a critical role towards maintaining the possibility for future luck or success. So, for example, during spring hunts, hunters only try to catch as many Ugzhruks as they need to make seal oil and dried meats to last until the following spring, which is typically about 4 mature Ugzhruks and 2 to 3 Unmiaq, or what people would call teenagers. During fall hunting, hunters are trying to catch seals for immediate consumption and to sell their skins to the local tannery. One hunting partner told me how he shot the biggest Ugzhruk he'd ever seen during a fall hunt, and then he brought it home and his mother scolded him. What did you do that for? We only get that kind during spring. It's important to note that actually Ugzhruks are much easier to hunt in the fall time. However, they're actually typically avoided because it's not a good time for outside preservation, which is the only way Ugzhruks are processed. Some hunters also explain that they avoid shooting bearded seals during the fall in order to increase their chances for having luck or success during spring hunts. For Shishmaref hunters, the issue is not whether animals are infinitely renewable, which has been a topic of much debate amongst scholars considering resource management practices amongst different northern indigenous peoples. What's significant is the recognition of possibility and the presence of sentience in the world, and therefore how one's actions and intentions can influence hunting success, and consequently, the need to avoid or minimize potentially limiting one's chances for success in future spring hunts. So, the suggested premise for self-regulation, then, is to maintain the best possible chances for catching Ugzhruks during spring hunts. And through hunters' interactions with Ugzhruks and empirical observations, they experience them as powerful and responsive beings that have much influence in determining the outcome of a hunt. So in local hunting lexicon, some hunters may be experienced or understood as tame, and allow hunters to shoot at them, while others are considered wild. They'll stay far away. They'll never come up long enough for hunters to shoot at them. And at the same time, a tame Ugruk may become wild, and a wild one may become tame. Some individuals are experienced as smart. Some individuals are considered pretty dumb. Some will let you shoot at them, and others will sink really fast after you shoot them in order to not let you win and to mess up your luck for future hunting opportunities. So because Ugruks are these powerful and active co-participants shaping the outcome of hunting encounters, and the extent of their perceptive powers can never be fully known, even when not hunting or while preparing for hunt, many hunters exercise extreme caution in how they behave towards Ugruks and other animals. Even in the village, hunters are careful about how they discuss hunting and how they discuss bearded seals. Clifford, who you can see on the right, who was my primary hunting partner and my instructor in Shishmaref, would always tell me before we were going out, "Don't ever say we're going hunting. Just say we're going to go look around, because you never know what's going to happen out on the country or out on the sea ice. We might not even see anything." Clifford would always talk about luck, and he would seek to manifest luck by avoiding making predictions about the possibility of catching animals, because, as he said, in his experience, such predictions could potentially result in lands and animals responding to his actions by not revealing animals.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and part three of our series, Exploring Ethnobiology. We're listening to Josh Wisniewski, a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who spoke in May 2010 at the annual gathering of the Society of Ethnobiologists hosted at the University of Victoria. Josh has spent many years studying Kikitamu Inupiaq hunters in the community of Shishmaref, Alaska, on the coast of the Bering Sea. Of greatest interest to Josh has been the relationships that these hunters have developed with the marine mammals that they hunt.
What is significant in the recognition is the recognition through hunters' actions of a direct and personal relationship between hunters and animals. These personal relational understandings inform and shape hunting practices, as well as the shared understandings amongst hunters. It's also interesting to note that there's not a direct translation of luck into Kikitamu Inupiaq, nor is luck generally discussed in historic and contemporary Inuit ethnographies in which hunting figures prominently. For Shishmaref hunters, however, luck is synonymous with success in catching Ugruks. Luck is regularly used as a substitute for talking about catching Ugruk in an effort to increase the chances of success by avoiding directly referencing them. Regardless of its potential historic basis, seeking to manifest luck is central towards hunting in Shishmaref today. While avoiding direct references to Ugruk hunting prior to hunting trips is one way hunters attempt to increase their chances for catching them, hunters also downplay the role their actions have towards catching Ugruks in hunting stories and conversations by suggesting them as play. So Clifford would often say, "Let's go play, look around. I play shot that Ugruk," or, "Josh, play bring your rifle, we might see something." These and other similar phrases were commonly used by hunters during, before, and after hunting, and in a variety of conversational circumstances. Yet, in a manner so as to always to diminish their active role towards catching animals. At the same time, despite the best intentions by hunters to encourage the possibility for achieving success, there are lots of times, more often than not, when hunters are unable to catch Ugruk, even when Ugruit are experienced as quite tame. Hunters refer to this as having a messed up system.
Josh Wisniewski's work has focused on this cultural practice that some hunters employ to help ensure a good harvest of bearded seals, a practice which Westerners might refer to as luck. But calling this practice as luck might be a bit misleading. As Josh explains, when bearded seals are not caught, hunters refer to this as a, quote, messed up system. But what is this system that they speak of? As Josh describes, this system is the subtlety with which Kikitamu hunters are aligned with the present moment and aligned with the animals which they're hunting. Just as some might identify with the outcomes of meditation or yoga as bringing oneself more into the present moment, this presence is, too, cultivated by Kikitamu hunters.
The ability to get luck or to have success is not presumed to exist solely within a hunter, which assumes a degree of personal authority to predict and control the outcome of a hunt, which the rules of old folks suggest is dangerous. Nor is it solely attributed to or blamed on animals. A dismissal of personal actions and intentions towards getting luck is equally considered dangerous. The personal assumption of responsibility, suggested through the statement, "My system was messed up," speaks to a disjunction of the body-mind-self. It's a failure to live or fully be present in the moment. The failure to connect with animals in the flow of a moment results from a failure to be in the moment of one's own immediate experience. Equally, though, is the recognition that animals are aware of and responding to hunters, one's actions, attitudes, presentation of self, and the ability or inability to connect with an animal. Having a messed up system for Shishmaref hunters does not also speak to a singularity of possibilities or events, for one system includes but is not limited to their shooting skills, the presence of the hunter, their being in the moment, and the ability to interact with and respond to animals. This is the ability to regulate one's breathing, to hold one's rifle steady, anticipate where a seal will rise out of the water, to hold a breath, to let it out slow, to squeeze, not pull the trigger. The reference point hunters use to suggest one's system is messed up are their interactions with animals, the personal experience of not being able to hit an animal when it's shooting at, the combination of bad shooting, the recognition of animals' awareness and responsiveness to human actions are experienced simultaneously and intricately connected towards one's ability to get luck. And yet, it's important to speak directly to the messy ethnographic reality of what people do. While some hunters might understand their inability to get luck or success during a given hunt as a response to their system being messed up, other hunters have very different range of experientially informed explanations for their success, or lack thereof, based on their own personal life histories. What this kind of points out is that Shishmaref hunters highlight that knowing emerges from a position of embeddedness in a context of experienced relations that don't disallow for objective analysis of phenomena, but always seek to ground it in the context of the experienced world. What this illuminates about Shishmaref hunters' ways of knowing are that no explanations are central, and what one has experienced and holds true to their own experiences is what is significant in their own hunting, their own self-regulation, and relational management strategies. In conclusion, I'd just like to point out that, in contrast with the long history of indigenous peoples' interactions with marine mammals, and not saying more than what one can safely say about continuity, in contrast to that, non-local engagements within the region and with marine mammals are fairly recent. Commercial whalers didn't pass through Bering Strait until 1848, and systematic commercial hunting of walrus took place between 1868 and 1883. Following that, modern scientific investigations of Arctic marine pinnipeds did not begin until the 1950s, and despite increased effort in recent years, scientific knowledge of Arctic pinniped ecology in the Bering and Chukchi Seas is still relatively recent. In contrast to modern bioecological studies, Kikitamu and other Inukbiak and Yupik hunters' understandings of Arctic pinnipeds has a much greater temporal depth and is continuously informed and analyzed through local experiential, observational, and reflexive means. To that end, we see that Shishmaref hunters' ways of experiencing and coming to know the lived-in world can teach us much about human-marine mammal relational ecology, as well as the human condition of knowing through our living in the world. Goyanak. Thank you.
And that was Josh Wisniewski, a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Josh spoke about his research at the May 2010 gathering of the Society of Ethnobiologists in Victoria, British Columbia. This has been part 3 in our series Exploring Ethnobiology, and you can access parts 1 and 2 through the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. And you can also expect more episodes of this series featuring recordings from Deconstructing Dinner's visits to that Victoria conference and to the International Congress of Ethnobiology held in Tofino. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show was provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.